Hello and welcome to this interview with Jim Al-Khalili about his book, The World According to Physics. My name is George Miller, and just after Jim finished recording his book, I had the chance to sit down with him in the studio and find out more about his inspirations and motivations for writing it. A glimpse behind the scenes of The World According to Physics, if you like. But we started with the experience of being in the studio. This is the first of Jim's books that he's narrated himself, so I asked him what that had been like.
Well, I actually found it quite an enjoyable experience. I've never narrated my own book. I mean, I've done voiceover for TV documentaries. I do radio broadcasting. This is the first time I've read my own words, as it were, on a book. I've enjoyed it. It felt quite natural. People say I tend to write the way I speak anyway. They say they can hear my voice as they're reading my books.
Now, in the book, Jim, you talk about your relationship with physics being a case of love at first sight. So maybe you can take us back and just say a little bit more about that moment. How did it occur and how did it feel?
As a boy, I have a brother who's 2 years younger than me. And I have to be honest, he was geekier than me when it came to science. You know, he knew the names of all the dinosaurs. He had a telescope. I was interested in football and pop music and girls from an unhealthy early age. And it sort of happened suddenly. You know, when I was about 13 or 14, I remember I was good at class at school in all subjects. I enjoyed maths. I was good at maths. I found it easy. And I remember doing particularly well in a class test in physics. And a lot of my friends didn't do so well. And I remember the teacher hauling me out in front of the class, sort of patting me on the head and sort of wanting to know why no one else could have done as well as I did on the test. And you'd think at that age, I'd just want a hole in the ground to open up and bury me. But I felt, I don't know, rather pleased with myself. I was thinking, oh, well, clearly I'm quite good at this physics subject. And I came to realize quite quickly that physics, for me anyway, is really common sense and problem solving. And I enjoyed both those things. And I realized it was a subject that could give me answers to a lot of the questions that were sort of bubbling up in my mind. You know, does the universe go on forever? What does the inside of an atom look like? What is time really? I realised that I had to study physics if I really wanted any hope of getting some answers.
Do you remember if there were inspirations that you latched onto in the early part of your experience, of whether books or individual figures, those people that sort of inspired you to keep exploring the world of physics?
Well, until the age of 16, I grew up in Iraq. So my father's Iraqi, my mother's English, and we'd come over to England every few years for summer holidays, but we finally settled in the UK when I was 16, so I didn't really have much access to heroes or to books or to TV documentaries that would satisfy my thirst for some of these ideas and the questions that I had. I remember visiting the British Council Library in Baghdad on a regular basis and borrowing all the books that they had. But, you know, it wasn't a very particularly big selection. So it wasn't really until I got to university and started studying physics that I discovered, you know, the wealth of information that was out there. And also remember, this is before the internet. So there simply wasn't that, you know, there wasn't the access to all this information that we have now. There weren't even the popular science books out there. There were very few authors who were writing popular books on physics, people like John Gribbin or Frank Close or Paul Davis. It wasn't until after Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time that suddenly popular science writing sort of exploded onto the scene and continues to this day. So I'm almost envious of youngsters getting into science, getting into physics now, because there's so much available to inspire them.
One of the lessons that I've taken from reading your book is that common sense and physics can only take you so far. The further you go, the more you encounter things which really seem to defy common perception.
Absolutely. And in a sense, that's what this book is all about. The common sense physics, the stuff that you learn at school, is logical. It does make sense if you think about it. But so much of modern physics on the very boundaries of what we understand about the universe do defy common sense, whether it's quantum mechanics talking about atoms being in two places at once, or whether it's asking questions like, How did the Big Bang happen? How could something emerge from nothing? If you apply common sense to some of those answers, you don't get very far. It really does require creativity and imagination in a way that people don't really tend to associate with scientific thinking.
Mm. Now, one way, I guess, of approaching the subject of your book might have been to go back through the history of physics and to talk about it in terms of the big breakthroughs, the big revolutions that have transformed the way physics is practiced. But you've deliberately decided not to go down that path. Why not?
I think a lot of authors have written about the history of physics. I mean, I've written about it as well. And one way of telling the story of how we came to know what we know today is indeed to trace it back all the way to the ancient Greeks. But what I wanted to do, because this is a neat, sort of almost pocket-sized, tight format book, I wanted to skip the whole history, the journey, and I wanted to give the reader an idea of where we are now. What is our current understanding at the very boundaries of what we know? I often think of, and I'm not the only one, a lot of authors write about this, they say that our scientific knowledge is like an island surrounded by an ocean of the unknown. And as our understanding of the laws of nature grows, the size of the island grows. So we sort of spread out into the ocean. This book is an exploration of the shoreline, walking around the edge of the island, checking what we know and what is out there that we have yet to understand and resolve.
Another very interesting metaphor that I have recalled from your book is that of the person who loses his keys on the way home one night, a dark night, and there is a choice between looking in the pools of light around the lampposts or groping around in the dark. And I thought that was a very interesting and memorable metaphor. What were you getting across there in terms of talking about how physics is actually practiced today?
Yes, well, it is an interesting metaphor. I mean, the idea is if you lose your keys somewhere along your walk home, you could do one of two things. You could either search under the lamplight where there's enough light to find the keys if they are there. But on the other hand, there's much more space between the lampposts, which is in darkness, where the keys are more likely to have fallen, but where it's harder to find them. So which do you do? And to some extent, physics research is a bit like that. There are those who look where we know we might find some answers, where their ideas maybe can be tested by experiments in the lab. They are likely to have some success in making advances, but those advances might tend to be incremental. There are others, the searchers in the dark, who are prepared to look where no one else is looking, to come up with ideas and theories and speculate in a way that might be quite hard to test. And yet, if they are successful, then that may well lead to a revolution, a paradigm shift in our understanding. And there are examples throughout the history of physics where people have taken that leap into the unknown and suggested some new idea, which eventually has turned out to be right. Of course, many others who come up with outlandish theories and ideas, of course, fail, because that's not the way the universe works.
And that tension between the theoretical and the empirical seems to be a very creative one. I mean, from the way you describe it in the book, it's as though physics sort of occupies a sweet spot. I mean, if you go further in one direction, you come to maybe pure mathematics. And if you go in the opposite direction, maybe you come to the application of physics in engineering. But the terrain that you're talking about seems to be a very creative one in the middle.
Yes, I think partly that comes from my own background in my research field in nuclear physics. When I first started my PhD, it was very clear that you could go along one of two paths. You became a theoretical physicist or an experimental physicist. And in nuclear physics, the two always work hand in hand. So a theoretical physicist like me would come up with a theory or a model to explain some property of an atomic nucleus. And then we might ask an experimentalist to do an experiment to test if that theory is correct or not. But an experimentalist might equally well carry out an experiment, come up with some data, and require the theorist to try and explain what they've seen, a theory that would fit the data. So always in my career, in my research career, theory and experiments have worked together. And I think in general, physics has that unique place in science. There are some areas of science that are much more empirical or based on observation. And as you say, there are other areas which are much more theoretical. Pure mathematics doesn't require experimental verification. But physics is an empirical science, but it's also one that uses mathematics, the language of nature, to try and understand how nature works.
So would I be pushing it too far to say that really, to you and your colleague, the world according to physics is in fact the world?
I would say so, yes. I do get a bit philosophical and polemical in the book here and there, but by and large I try and say what we know, what we don't know, and why we don't know it. Certainly there will be sort of more philosophically minded physicists who would say that, no, the job of physics isn't to say how the world actually is. It's really more about what we can say about the world. According to some versions of quantum mechanics, there isn't an objective reality out there waiting to be discovered. I don't buy that. I side with Einstein on this issue, which is that the world out there, and by world here, of course, I mean the entire universe, the whole of reality, exists. And it's our job as physicists to try and understand, to reach that ultimate truth about how things are. So the world, according to physics, is indeed the world itself, the reality that we're trying to find.
Because against that Einstein view, which seeks to explain the world, is the Copenhagenist view, which is content to describe it. That's a tension that you see ongoing in the discipline.
Yes, and it's very interesting. It's almost a recurring theme throughout this book. When quantum mechanics was developed in the 1920s, suddenly there were these two schools of thought, most famously recounted by this long-running argument between Einstein and Niels Bohr, the Danish physicist regarded as the father of quantum mechanics. The Copenhagenist view refers to Niels Bohr's institute in Copenhagen, where he built this school of thought around him, including people like Werner Heisenberg and Wolfgang Pauli. And their view was very different from that of Einstein's. They said, no, the job of physics isn't to find out how the world is. All we can ever do is build models that somehow give us an approximation of reality that we may never reach. I grew up, I was trained in quantum mechanics to follow this Copenhagenist view because it was the standard traditional dogma. Over the years, I and many other theoretical physicists, I think, and certainly in recent years, have moved away from this. We would now regard the Copenhagen view as not really being true to the spirit of what physics is about. Physics is about trying to reach the ultimate truth of reality.
And it's interesting, isn't it, to see that as time goes on, as a discipline learns more and hypothesizes more, that doesn't necessarily bring that moment of certainty any closer. I mean, I think you say that we're perhaps less certain than we were 20 or 30 years ago, but that's not necessarily a sign of a deficiency in the discipline.
No. In fact, the fact that there are still mysteries to resolve and questions to answer is great. Otherwise, you know, I'd be out of a job. It's a bit like, you know, you're looking forward to Christmas and unwrapping all your presents. Once you've unwrapped the presents and you've appreciated them, it's sort of a bit of an anticlimax. And so it's nice that physics hasn't provided us with all the answers about the nature of reality. And yes, 30, 40 years ago, I think a lot of physicists did believe we were approaching the end of physics, that we had almost reached this holy grail, the theory of everything, the equation you could stick on your T-shirt that explained all the forces and phenomena in nature. Now we're beginning to realise that actually, no, we're still a long way off from that ultimate truth. And indeed, we may never get there. We're trying to improve our theories and our understanding and get ever closer to it, but maybe we'll never reach it. But we certainly know there are mysteries out there that we don't understand, that we do need to be able to crack to move forward.
And this made me smile when you said that although the existence of the Higgs boson was hypothesized in the 1960s, when it was actually proved by the Large Hadron Collider in 2012, there was actually, you know, some sort of palpable disappointment among the community of physicists. And what does that say about the discipline?
Well, I think it's fair to say that it was mixed feelings.
Okay.
On the one hand, this was a tremendous achievement, certainly in sort of in experimental physics and engineering, what the Large Hadron Collider was able to do, and to be able to confirm the existence of this particle that existed merely as mathematical symbols in the work of Peter Higgs and others for half a century. But on the other hand, yes, it ticked a box. You know, we had suggested our current best understanding of the building blocks of matter suggested that this particle should exist. And sure enough, we found it. Great. But, you know, had we not found it, that would have meant that our ideas, our current theories weren't correct, and they'd have to be replaced with something else. And it's back to the drawing boards. And so it means we need to get more creative and come up with a new theory. And after all, that's our job. That's what we want to do. If we had all the theories in place and all the answers, well, life would be boring.
Now, someone like me coming to the book from a humanities background was a little surprised by how often beauty and the aesthetic actually comes into the discourse about an equation or a proof or a hypothesis. Can you say a little bit more about that aspect of physics, which maybe surprises the outsider?
Yes, I mean, I often get frustrated when people are surprised that science also requires creativity and imagination, because those tend to be things associated with the arts. Science is about, you know, logic and gathering of data and accumulation of facts. Well, certainly in theoretical physics, that's far from true. When I'm working on an algebraic calculation, I might start with trying to define my mathematical model, and it'll be a jumble of symbols and calculus and algebra, which is very messy. Being able to work that down and reach some nugget, some compact equation that encapsulates some phenomenon in nature, I find that incredibly beautiful. And, you know, I can appreciate the aesthetic beauty of a load of Greek symbols in very similar way to the way I might appreciate a work of art or music. Now, to some extent, this appreciation may be not available to the person who hasn't spent their lives understanding the meaning of the mathematics. But to us, there really is an aesthetic beauty to the way nature behaves in this logical, mathematical way. And many theoretical physicists have indeed been driven almost entirely by this search for aesthetics and beauty, almost to the extent that, you know, if an experiment, I mean, there have been physicists who said, if an experiment suggests that my beautiful theory is wrong, go away and repeat the experiments, because nature is not going to do anything other than produce something beautiful like this.
Yeah, as you say, this is not just the phenomenon of physicists being tidy-minded and liking to tidy things up. It's actually part of this process of discovering more about the underlying nature of nature itself, of reality itself.
And time and again, this search for beauty and simplicity has been successful in leading to an understanding that, after which, you know, we've discovered was indeed the true way that nature works. So following your nose and looking for beauty in the mathematics is often a very good indicator that you're on the right track. Mm.
You mentioned just there the messy algebra that you may start with, and I hope you'll maybe permit me a rather naive question, which is this. When you are doing physics, what does it look like? Are you biting the end of a pencil? Are you working on a computer? What is it that you are doing in order to advance your discipline?
Well, in theoretical physics, it's very different from an experimentalist. So an experimentalist will go in a lab, they'll have an idea of what they want to measure, and they think of ingenious ways of setting up their instruments to try and capture nature in the act. For a theoretical physicist, it is. It's a combination of doing algebra, writing equations down, doing calculus, and then maybe getting as far as you can on paper and realizing that you've got some integration, some calculus to do that needs help from a computer. So you then turn around and start coding up a program on your computer, and that will churn out numbers. It's a very messy, complicated process because, you know, you write a program and it produces numbers. Well, you don't know if you've made a mistake in your coding. So you're always thinking of ways of checking what you've done, checking your maths against other known theories, tested theories, checking it against observations, against data to make sure you're on the right track. So it's a mixture of head scratching, staring at a whiteboard that you've scribbled some diagrams on, scribbling an equation on paper, looking something up in a textbook, or sitting down and tapping on your keyboard to write a computer program. It's a nice, rich mix of lots of different ways of probing nature.
You write in the book about thinking like a physicist. Do you think there are, if I can put it this way, transferable skills, that there are things which physicists do, the way they approach problems and the world, which actually have wider applicability? I mean, I'm not necessarily talking about inventions, but actually in the wider populace, about thinking in the way that a physicist might think about a problem.
I hope so. I mean, part of our training as scientists, not just in physics, but in all of science, in following the scientific method, is to, well, first of all, to be prepared to change your mind if your way of thinking, your theory, your hypothesis is shown to be wrong. To be able to admit that you're wrong, to admit that you make mistakes. I mean, in this sense, you know, doing science is very different from politics. You know, how many times do you hear a politician admitting that they were wrong? But in science, certainly for me in physics, if you don't make mistakes, you don't progress. That's how we learn something new, because we realize our current idea or theory was deficient in some way, or even barking up the wrong tree. There's also the idea of honesty. Science and the scientific method isn't another ideology. It's not a way of thinking. It's not something that, you know, to some extent, yes, I mean, scientists are people, right? And we have, you know, there are sort of subjectivity in it, in the sense that, you know, we have biases. We tend to be attached to certain ideas. But broadly, the way science works is that it's self-correcting, is that we're prepared to check what we know against other ideas, against observations, against data, and being prepared and honest enough to change our minds if we discover we're wrong. If only the rest of the world could... and also for the rest of the world to understand how science itself works. How do we know what we know? You know, we're not just coming up with... I have a theory that there are fairies at the bottom of my garden, and I know I'm right and you're wrong and you can't, I'm not prepared to debate with you. Science isn't like that. Science is about reproducibility, testing, checking, and changing your mind.
And you practice what you preach, don't you? Because in the book, you come clean about an error that you had made in a calculation. You could have just swept that under the rug and no one would have been any the wiser. But I sense that it was important to you to put that out there.
Yes, I mean, this is a great story. I love to tell it. I was actually making a BBC documentary in which we'd finished the filming. We'd almost finished editing and realised that I'd made a mistake, a quite crucial mistake in my explanation of Einstein's theory of gravity. And yes, we could have reshot those scenes where I made the mistake and no one would have been the wiser. But I genuinely felt very strongly that this was a wonderful opportunity to show how science works. So rather than covering up my mistake, I opened up about it. I showed it in all its glory. We filmed extra scenes where I said, I remember the point, I'm doing a piece to camera and I'm walking down a corridor in my university and I say something like, at this point, everything went a bit pear-shaped. And I go on to explain the mistake that I'd made and that I had to go away and think about it and talk to other physicists. And this was a great way of explaining that in science, it's okay to make mistakes. I remember people saying to me, oh, you're very brave to own up to your mistake, your error like that. I said, no, not at all. This is how science works. I don't feel embarrassed in the least.
You speculate in the book about whether we need another Einstein or Newton or Dirac or Bohr in order to make the next great leap forward. Or, and this was a fascinating speculation, you say perhaps AI is going to be the thing that will enable physics to make its next major breakthrough. I mean, where do you stand on that, the sort of individual versus the power of AI computing?
I think a lot of the problems at the frontiers of fundamental physics today are very, very difficult. And even a question like, what is the true, correct interpretation of quantum mechanics? You know, what is going on down at the subatomic level when a particle can be in two places at once? What does that mean? We know we have a multitude of different ways of explaining it and ideas and theories. We don't know which is the right one. And we've been thinking about that and banging our heads against the wall for nearly a century now. These problems are really hard. And I think with the developments of AI and machine learning, it may well be that we've got to the point where our primitive ape brains are simply not capable of bringing together everything that we know, solving the really difficult mathematical problems and making that next breakthrough. So, you know, I wasn't being sort of flippant when I say in the book that, you know, we're waiting for the next Einstein or Newton, but maybe that Einstein or Newton would have to be an artificial intelligence. It may well be that AI is needed to give us that helping hand to crack some of these most difficult of problems.
And will there always be another problem waiting after the one that's just been cracked? Is it sort of like a set of rooms that you open the door to one and then you see that at the end of that room there are a whole other set of doors?
I firstly believe that reality, the universe and matter and energy and space and time exist. And there are laws of physics that describe that reality. And we're trying to get as close to it as we can. So I don't think the layers of the onion that we're peeling to try and get to this deepest truth would go on forever. It may be that we approximate, get closer and closer to the truth, like that the famous Greek story of the frog sitting in the center of the pond, jumping from one lily leaf to the next, and each jump is half the distance of the previous one. Does it ever get to the edge of the pond? You know, we may be incrementally getting closer and closer, but never quite reaching that ultimate truth. But I don't think it's the case that we will always discover more complexity. I mean, that is true so far, but that doesn't mean necessarily that we're always going to find particles made up of deeper particles, made up of deeper particles, and so on.
What was the hardest concept to get across to the layperson when you're writing the book? I mean, there are lots of mind-boggling things in it, and you make them really, I wouldn't say easy to grasp, but you make it possible, and I think that was a terrific achievement. But some of them must have been quite challenging to boil them down and remain true to their essence and at the same time make it apparent to a layperson what they were about.
Yes, I think, you know, there were a few, and those are the ones that I obviously spent the longest thinking about and talking to colleagues and trying to distill what the essence is. I guess the ideas that I found most difficult are the ones probably furthest away from my own discipline. So I'm a quantum physicist, which is the opposite end of the scale from, you know, the very large, the cosmology, the theories of the entire universe. So, for example, current thinking is that our Big Bang, which traditionally we think of as the birth of space and time, you know, there is nothing before the Big Bang because that was the beginning of time itself. Now physicists are starting to question this. And so ideas such as something called eternal inflation, or how did the universe get its energy from in the first place? You know, where, you know, how can something emerge from nothing? We now have sort of quite good explanations and answers for how this may have been. And I certainly found it quite challenging to find the best way, the best metaphors to use, the examples to use to explain what's going on. But I think because I spent more time trying to unpack these ideas and try and look at them from different angles, I like to think they're the ones that are probably most clearly explained in the book than others that are, you know, that are well-trodden ground.
Jim, you're clearly in love with physics and have been for many years. In writing this book, what do you hope that you might impart to the reader and they might actually take away from it?
You know, very often people talk about scientists are just the children who've never stopped asking why, who've never stopped being curious about the world and how it works. And, you know, most people who move away from science have, you know, better things to do with their time. But I've realized over the years as a science communicator that everyone is curious about the world. The questions and the subjects that I deal with in this book are fascinating to everyone. It's usually what happens is that someone's been turned off science because they've had a bad teacher, for example, or that they've been told that physics is much too difficult for them, or that it's a geeky subject, not for them. But actually, a lot of people, when they grow up, they move off into all sorts of different careers. But when exposed to some of these wonderful, magical ideas about how the universe is, they are just as fascinated by it as I am. They fall in love with it in the same way that I do. My advantage is that I've never left it. I've spent all my life thinking about these questions. So I have this privileged position that I have a deeper understanding of some of these ideas, but it doesn't mean that others can't also feel an appreciation and love for the subject, even though they don't have maybe the mathematical expertise to solve the equations themselves.
I was talking to Jemal Khalili about The World According to Physics, one of a growing number of titles from Princeton University Press, available in audiobook format. You'll find full details of the audiobook catalogue on the Princeton University Press website, as well as news of forthcoming titles and an ideas segment that will introduce you to more of PUP's authors and books. From me, thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.